Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 259, The Slippery Slope of Reality, Part 2, with Jerry Trumbull.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Here's something, the transfer of information apparently happening instantaneously. And my joy was in finding, not the answer by any means, but at least the capability of a system that resides in our heads and our bodies of instantaneous communication at a distance, so that all of these microtubules would be in constant sync. And by the way, Hameroff is also an MD, an anesthesiologist, and has studied that aspect of consciousness to the extent that I was thinking, oh boy, this is a system that's big enough and it's seems to be capable of housing consciousness and our inner life.
That was the voice of my old friend and return guest, Jerry Trumbull, speaking about the work of Dr. Stuart Hameroff and its implications for science generally and the study of consciousness specifically. Jerry Trumbull, MS, ABD, and I have yet another one of our wide-ranging conversations. This is the second of what we hope will be three conversations. This time we focus on the work of Stuart Hameroff, MD, and Robert Lanza, MD. Dr. Hameroff has conducted very intriguing research on microtubules, tiny biological transistors, which suggests a memory system much larger and more complex than that provided through the synapses. Robert Lanza, MD, is considered one of the leading scientists in the world. He's currently chief scientific officer at Advanced Cell Technology and adjunct professor at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. He has hundreds of publications and inventions and over 24 scientific books, among them Principles of Tissue Engineering, which is recognized as the definitive reference in the field. As usual, our discussion, that between Jerry and myself, is both personal and psychological, and this time somewhat cosmological. Gerald Trumbull, B.S., University of Maryland, 1965, M.S., University of Pennsylvania, 1970, has been a neuropsychological researcher, Walter Reed, Army Institute of Research, and NASA, University of Maryland, and assistant professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He says, disgusted with academia, he moved to Denver in 1971, where he founded Sebastian High School, a gradeless experiential learning center, founded the Western States Film Institute with two winners of the Student Academy Awards, and in 1980, founded Denver's first computer training center. Now retired and living in obscurity, he says. He is a videographer and blogger. You'll find his blog at denverdirect.tv, where he expounds on local politics and pollution. He continues his lifelong interest in the workings of the human brain, exploring his own brain through hypnagogia and REM sleep, and hopes someday to upload the contents of his brain directly to the internet. Now, here's our conversation. Well, Jerry Trumbull, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome. I'm pleased to be back. It's just been a few minutes since we talked before.
Yes, but nobody knows that, so.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry.
Let's see. Well, we only announced it at the end of the last show. But yeah, we were having so much fun last time that we just kind of or I kind of used up all of our time going over that article in the New Yorker, which I won't do that again. But just let me say that if you missed our last conversation, you definitely want to hear the previous podcast that I did with Jerry Trumbull here, and which we discussed the article, The Truth Wears Off, Is There Something Wrong with the Scientific Method, written by Jonah Lerner in The New Yorker, December 13th, 2010. And you will find that on our website in the show notes. So, Jerry, we're going to continue our conversation. In the previous conversation, which we titled The Slippery Nature of Reality, and this will be The Slippery Nature of Reality Part 2.
Right.
And we were talking about sort of various kinds of biases that come into research, not just in psychology, but other disciplines as well, that have led to something called the decline effect. But the problems go deeper than that, don't they? There's the segue you've been looking for.
They certainly do, Dr. Dave. recent work by a number of investigators into what's now called neurobiology, or certainly the neuroscience, has, and in physics in general, has led to a very what I consider a very problematic situation. That is to say, the effect of the observer on reality. Scientists through the ages have decided that they should try to remove their own biases to the extent that they can from the experimental procedures. And as we mentioned before, that led to the double-blind study, where neither the subject nor the scientist were aware of which was the pill and which was the placebo. And of course, that led to the placebo effect.
Yeah, right.
In which it turned out that a sugar pill was almost as good as the real thing. And maybe that's part of the problem. But what really got me excited was the work of Stuart Hameroff. And I just recently discovered this, although what I also discovered was that he's been doing this work for the past 20 years.
And we should mention he's at the University of Arizona, right?
I think that's right, yeah. And throughout my studies of the brain, the mind, consciousness, I've always been somewhat leery of making a statement about where consciousness lives. The brain is very compact, as is said to contain 100 billion neurons, and that's a lot. And then with all of the interconnections between neurons, it's said to contain 100 trillion neural connections. And that's certainly a good sized computer.
Well, somebody that I recently interviewed had written in his book, and I don't remember which one, that the number of possible connections actually were greater than, I think it was, than the number of stars in the known universe.
Yeah, I've heard that statement before. Since we don't know the number of stars, it's kind of a nebulous statement. But anyway, it's huge. But what I always got hung up on a comparison of the inner life that we all have with the physical mechanism that we believe houses this inner life. Part of my problem was the transmission of an event from one neuron to the next, that it has to go from an electrical impulse in the neuron to a chemical release at the synapse, which excites another neuron, and so on.
Right.
And although these are measurable times, and they're pretty fast, milliseconds, it seemed like what was going on in my head was somehow above and beyond that. I just couldn't imagine that that the neurons were capable of housing what I think goes on in my head. And that's why I got very excited when I read about microtubules. Recall in our day when we studied the neuron, when we got down to the actual cell, the stuff on the inside, I believe it was called cytoplasm. And then you would see a nucleus, and then you would see a mitochondria would be in there for the energy. And the rest of the stuff was just kind of colored in.
Goo.
Goo. Yeah, it was the goo. And it turns out that the goo is another system altogether, a system of microtubules. Now, I don't pretend to be anything other than an amateur observer and reader in this area, but as I understand it, the microtubules are composed of self-folding proteins. So they kind of line themselves up into these little tubes. And the little tubes have a head and a tail, and they actually can pass proteins through them to various effects, including electrical effects. And here's the part that really caught my attention, that they don't rely on synaptic connections to other neurons. They have these little gap connections between neurons. It's like a little window between adjacent neurons, and that information can be passed through this gap, through these gaps that are in proximity to each other, at the quantum level. And, of course, the quantum level is where everything changes. Our whole Newtonian physics kind of dissolves away into probabilistic considerations. And maybe some of the listeners are old enough to remember the dual nature of light, when that was a big topic. Light was said to be a wave of energy. And yet, instances, it seemed to operate as a particle. So the question was, is light a particle or a wave? And for those of you who have access to YouTube, I would recommend that you search on Quantum Physics for Dummies, Part 1. It's actually a cartoon, and it very nicely describes the double slit experiment. And the double slit experiment has to do with trying to figure out whether light is a particle or a wave. If you have a single slit and you send particles through it, they pass through. Some of them pass through, some of them bounce off, and they show a pattern where they've gone through, kind of looking more or less like the slit, with a little bit, you know, of randomness on the edges. If you pass a wave through the single slit, the wave, and it's demonstrated in this cartoon by a water passing through, the wave, part of it goes through the slit, and then it is registered on the background as a more of a diffuse pattern. But the other thing that happens is that waves reinforce each other, and we've all seen this in the bathtub or in the ocean. What you get on the blackboard behind where they're hitting is an interference pattern, where there's a main bar down the middle, and then a gap, and then some lesser patterns to the side. And so that was going to be the way that we decided that whether light was a particle or a wave. Well, it turns out that when you put another slit in the same barrier, you come up with some very strange results. The particles, in this case, electrons, pass through and seem to line up where they hit in two bars. And the wave creates an interference pattern as before. But, and here's the astounding part. If they try to observe what's going on at the slit, it changes the results. And this is where we tie into the previous discussion about experimenter bias. It turns out in quantum physics that the observer is the key, and that at the quantum level, an observer looking at a wave causes what they call a collapse of the wave into a particle. And I was, when I first learned this, I was going like, well, wait a minute, that can't be. What is an observer? Is it a human? Is it a camera? Is it a squirrel watching something happen?
Right. Which is it?
Yeah. Well, apparently it's any observation of anything causes the collapse of this quantum state. Now, how
could they know that, though? How could they... I got hung up on the same place that I think you were just talking about getting hung up. And I think we're talking about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which people probably have at least heard that
expression. Yeah, that's where it kind of all started. The idea that you could not measure the speed of an electron or an atomic particle and its position at the same time.
Right, right.
If you measured one, you couldn't measure the other. And it was kind of like taking a frame out of a movie. You couldn't measure its speed. You could see where it was, but you couldn't measure its speed with that single frame. But suddenly, my mind began to boggle because as a kid, I remember having the thought that I was the only real thing in the universe.
And that I think that thought has crossed most of our minds.
I think so.
Not that Jerry Trumbull is the only person in the universe.
No, you're walking down the street and you see all these other people going by, and then you turn a corner. And as a kid, I remember thinking, maybe they're all just robots and they all just stop when right. I stop looking at them.
Yeah.
And if I turn around quickly, they all start up again.
Yeah.
So there's no way to fool them. And so what we're finding here in quantum physics, that's kind of more or less true, that the observer has a profound effect on the results. Now, some of these, I have to admit, 5 years ago, having a little extra time on my hands, I decided to undertake the study of quantum physics. And so I bought a bunch of books, and I read, or I made an attempt to read some of these books. Some of them were way beyond me mathematically, but some of them were written for people like me, and they described quantum entanglement and the collapse of the wave and so on and so forth, quantum tunneling, and I was going like, I'm just not getting this. By the way, I should also add that I sold all these books back on Amazon because they were very popular. So I bought them, I read them, and then I sold them again quickly. And it wasn't until, I can't even remember the name of the one that it said, if you don't understand this, don't dismay because nobody understands it.
Yeah. It's also anti-intuitive.
Exactly. How can something be in two places at once? Well, it's a probabilistic field. It's not really. It's kind of everywhere at the same time until you actually pin it down. And then that probabilistic field collapses down to a single particle, which will appear randomly somewhere in that field you were looking at. And I'm going like, this is just too bizarre.
Let me cut in here because there are two topics on the table, and I want to try to separate them a little bit so that we can go into both. And one is this uncertainty that you're talking about, this Heisenberg uncertainty principle as it manifests itself. The other is the microtubules topic that you started to broach, and I know there's some crossover, but the exciting piece of the microtubule thing that I'd like to make sure we bring out is because you referred me to a YouTube video by Stuart Hameroff, who I think the video that I saw, he was presenting to the folks at Google. Do I remember? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And the parts that I could understand, here's what I took away. I couldn't follow it all, but the part that really impressed me, and as he was talking about microtubules, was that each microtubule, and these are tiny, tiny, tiny things, can hold a byte of information. I think he said they could hold 6 bits of information. And so they're like tiny little computers, if you will. And as you pointed out, they can communicate with one another non-synaptically.
And instantaneously. And that's the...
That's the tie-in to the quantum thing. Go ahead.
Exactly. Because what they are proposing is that the microtubules operate at the quantum level, and that they can... There's something, let's see, what do they call it? It's quantum of effects are generally just one particle, but they can operate in unison. And what I took away from other information presented by Hameroff was that all the microtubules in all of the neurons in your entire body could communicate with each other instantaneously. And this is one of the mystifying parts of the quantum explanation. It involves something called quantum entanglement. And basically, as I understand it, if you take a set of particles and split them into two and send them in the opposite direction, and then you... And it's been described a couple of different ways. If you look at the spin on mm-hmm. on one of the particles,
right,
the other particle will automatically have the opposite spin.
Right. And there's a way, evidently, to manipulate the spin of the first particle to reverse it.
Yeah.
And then the other one reverses the other way.
Exactly.
No matter how far apart they are in the
right.
in the universe, theoretically.
Yeah, I think they did one that was 7 miles apart.
Yeah.
And it's instantaneous. So that kind of breaks the speed of light rule.
Oh, yeah, faster than the speed of light. Yeah.
Nothing can happen faster than the speed of light. Well, here's something, the transfer of information apparently happening instantaneously. And my joy was in finding, not the answer by any means, but at least the capability of a system that resides in our heads and our bodies of instantaneous communication at a distance, so that all of these microtubules would be in constant sync. And by the way, Hameroff is also an MD, an anesthesiologist, and has studied that aspect of consciousness to the extent that I was thinking, oh boy, this is a system that's big enough, and it seems to be capable of housing consciousness and our inner life.
Well, I love the way you said my joy is, and I guess my sense of joy around this is I've been reading a book by Stanislav Grof, MD, PhD, who I will be interviewing. Actually, it's going to be on my Wise Counsel podcast series, so I don't know if that will have happened already by the time people hear this discussion or not. But at any rate, I've been reading his book, When the Impossible Happens, Adventures in Non-Ordinary Realities.
Wow.
And he goes way out there. In terms of talking, he talks about memories from the uterine, from being in the uterus, which I've always been skeptical of. He talks about memories that go back to the moment of conception. then memories that go back to before that, memories of past lives, ESP, and all of that stuff that, you know, and sort of Carl Jung's conceptions of the cellular memory, if you will, in the collective unconscious.
The archetype,
and, and so all of that has seemed, from a scientific point of view, pretty far-fetched in terms of certainly in terms of any kind of Newtonian paradigm. These microtubules, though, to me, open up the possibility of, well, if they're that tiny, then they could live in a gene. Live in a gene, then that means that such things as racial memories, etc., could be passed on genetically. And it also opens up the possibility, and of course we're being very speculative here, but what you're talking about, the entanglement and instant communication, that could also open up the possibility for the kinds of ESP experiences that people experience and report.
Exactly. In fact, it's even bigger than that. And I would refer to the listeners to a paper by Robert Lanza called The Biocentric Universe Theory, Life Creates Time, Space, and the Cosmos Itself. Because what I'm starting to feel excited about is the fact that at this quantum level, and I know there's a temptation to throw everything down to the quantum level and just kind of mix it all together and say, well, okay, that's the way it works then. That must be. But there's also a, once again, Stuart Hameroff has a paper online called Is Consciousness Connected to the Fine Structure of the Universe? And I would recommend that to the listener as well, because basically it sounds like at the quantum level, we are all one.
Ta-da! Ta-da! Back to Buddhism.
There it is. There it is. The answer. We finally found. No, it's not the answer by any means, but it looks like a framework. If you can accept this, the mystery of the quantum level, it looks like a framework that would explain so much of what we find mysterious in all of this today. You know, I have a hard time with my feeble brain trying to wrap it around these concepts. But when Hameroff is just he's a dynamite speaker, and he's just so enthusiastic and so knowledgeable and he's got all kinds of YouTube movies and other sources that you can find online.
And I should mention, I have sent him an invitation to be a guest. I've not heard back from him yet.
Well, I certainly hope he accepts, because I would love to hear him discuss this once again. He seems to be totally energetic when it comes to speaking about it. Just the idea that the observer, life, creates time, space, and the cosmos itself. Is this possible?
I know. You sent me the link. I'm now remembering. You sent me a link. To something by Lanza.
Yeah, that was it. That was the paper.
Yeah, and I should, one of us should remind me to make sure that I put that link in on the show notes for this interview.
Yeah, there's just so much. I started to put together a kind of a linkology, linkography, and there was just so much. I thought, you know, just go to Google and search on Robert Lanza or search on Stuart Hameroff, and there's more than you need to get into this. And then it comes down to, is this a belief system, or is this a way to determine the truth? I'm starting to think the concept of the truth is probably what we have to give up here.
Well, that's sort of, in a way, that seems to be one of the implications of what they're saying. Now, I wrestle with this, you know, in terms of being a moderator of discussions here and trying to to get out the word about psychological truth, and sort of making decisions about who I'll interview and who I'm not comfortable interviewing because they, for me, they're a little too kooky or far out.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And, you know, how do I balance that? I mean, we still, and despite what we've said, I mean, don't we still have some belief in science and some way of filtering information? How do you come out on that? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And I think what it boils down to, for me at least, is the understanding that science itself is a belief system. It's nothing more or less than that. And at the quantum level, they always make the argument, well, we know that you can't understand this, but every single experimental test that we have ever devised has shown that this is true, that the quantum level exists and this is how it operates. And it has all these freaky things about two places at once and instantaneous communication and tunneling. And, you know, let's face it, the transistor, the diode, which is the basis of the transistor, operates on a quantum principle, quantum tunneling. An electron is on one side of a barrier, and suddenly it's on the other side. The barrier was impenetrable, but it shows up on the other side. So they call that quantum tunneling. And maybe we've come up against the old idea that an Apple IIe computer could not simulate the operation of a MacBook because it's too limited. Maybe our brains will never understand this. I hate to say this because it sounds mystical in some way.
But, right.
And you know how I feel about that. But maybe it's true. Maybe we just, if they keep testing this and the quantum level turns out to be the way they describe it, with all of these things that we can't rationalize because we only have experience in the Newtonian world, you know, maybe we'll just have to, maybe eventually it will be incorporated into common knowledge. I don't know. But, you know, something being two places at once, Schrodinger's cat and all that, you know, it's kind of like, oh no. Well, the world is not formed up of hard little balls, you know,
yeah,
bouncing off of each other.
Right. Well, you know, I live here in California where all sorts of ideas abound, and you know, I'll reveal my own bias here, which is the result, I guess, of academic training as well as probably some kind of temperamental things, you know, wanting to differentiate myself, I guess, from New Age airheads,
yeah,
who will, exactly, you know, who will quote quantum physics as you know, showing that all things are possible, and therefore they can sort of continue to float in basically a sort of anti-intellectual space, if you will.
Yeah, I think there's a big danger of that. I feel myself floating in that suit myself right now, actually. Yeah. No, but the idea that, oh yeah, you can't understand this, but this is the way it works. And it's so open to that kind of catch-all. Oh wow, we don't know how it could possibly work, but it must be happening at the quantum level.
Yeah. You
know? Like down there, anything is possible. You know, there's no such thing as time, and the observer creates the cosmos. Oh my God, help!
Yeah, right, help. There was, you know, there used to be the metaphor or analogy of reality as a very complicated clock. That was the old mechanistic model.
Exactly.
And then the more recent model has been the computer. And yes. everything has been described in relation to, you know, with reference to the computer. Mm-hmm. To what extent is this some kind of a new metaphor, maybe?
Well, that's a good question, I think, because I it occurred to me as well, you know, that when we get down to when we find a new system inside of the neuronal system, are we just reducing it down one level? And now we're hypothesizing that these magical things can occur where they don't have to actually, this tunneling through the gaps, in the neurons, instantaneous communication throughout all the neurons in your body at one time. Is that for real? I mean, how do we measure that? How do we get down there with it? Maybe Hameroff will have some answers.
Well, Hameroff refers to Penrose, and I haven't read anything about Penrose, and I think you have. What does Penrose bring to the soup?
Well, Penrose, as I recall, as a kind of old school neurophysiologist, and it was kind of towards the end of his career when he wrote The Emperor's New Mind. And he was proposing something like this, but he didn't have the physical mechanism. And Hameroff brought the microtubules to the argument. Now, I haven't read The Emperor's New Mind. I'm going to read it, but I haven't read it yet. But that was kind of the starting place that got Hameroff interested. And then the two of them collaborated, and then they came up with this new model. And I find it exciting because it seems capable of housing the mind. It also, by the way, seems capable of housing the spirit and the soul. So I'll go way out on a limb.
Yeah.
It's all down there at the quantum level, somehow mixing around. And by the way, in my mind, and once again, feeble as it is, it seems to give some credibility to this, to many of the mysteries of life that we have been hammering away at for hundreds of years now, of, you know, mothers waking up in the middle of the night knowing that their child is in danger.
Right.
Telecommunication, teleportation, all, you know, who knows? It's kind of scary, because it's in my mind, it's kind of ill-defined at this time, and that's why I really hope that you can get Hameroff on the show and maybe ask him some critical questions. How are we? I don't know that he has all the answers. I don't think he believes he does. I think he believes that what he's proposing is a system that's capable of doing the kinds of things that we believe that this monster computer that houses our brains could operate. Whereas the neuron didn't have any kind of on-off state. The qubit, as he calls it, the one little part of the microtubule, does have that. In fact, it has off, on, and then in between it has indeterminate. It has a quantum state where it's neither off nor on. And so that, maybe that's better or maybe it's worse. I don't know.
Wow.
I just find it to be very exciting.
Yeah. Now, one of my correspondents, recent guest, Peter B. Todd in Australia, has been urging me to interview Carl Pribram, which I'm sure is a name that you would recognize.
I do.
And evidently in his, he's probably a pretty old guy now. And,
yeah, it must be.
And I'm getting the impression that he has ventured off into some of these realms of speculation.
Good.
Do you know anything about his recent writing or work?
No, I don't. I remember the name, but that's all.
Yeah, that's about where I am. So
we'll have to do
add that to your list.
Yes, I just have.
Okay.
Just wrote it down. Yeah.
And then you can tell me what he said. But yeah. he was a big name right in brain study, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and Donald Hebb, I think, also has.
Hebb, I remember that one.
And he's another classical neuropsychologist. And mm-hmm. And I have the impression that he too has got some far out ideas.
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but I've noticed throughout my life that as people get older, they tend to want to settle on an answer. You know, they've been tossing around all their life trying to figure out what is the meaning of life. You know, is there an afterlife? Is there some form of reincarnation, or how does it work? And that as they grow older, they kind of pick one. You know,
yeah, right.
It's getting a little late in the game, so I think I'll just pick one of these and go with that. You know, and now I want to be a Catholic.
Well.
Call in a priest right now because I think I'm dying. So, and I don't want to fall into that. I don't want to be, I've always been a seeker, and I don't want to pick an answer because it's comfortable now that I'm old.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you'll remember this, but I remember when we were young, we were both, you know, we were in college, but we were in our adolescence.
Yeah.
And we had this conversation. I think we were calling it the leap, and that you had to have the courage to make the leap.
Yeah,
rather
that's exactly
than
right.
Rather than getting settled on a solution. Do you? And I remember you speaking really passionately about that. Do you remember that conversation?
As a matter of fact, I have about 150 pages of a novel called The Leap.
Oh wow.
And it stars you and me.
Oh, hey, amazing.
I still have it. It's handwritten, and I still have it. It's all yellow and falling apart and everything, but I still have it. You've inspired me to go back and take a look at that.
Oh, good. Yeah. Wow. That would be great. That would be the perfect culmination of our lives.
Yeah, then we could just say, oh, just read our book there. It's called The Leap. You'll have to get to it eventually yourself.
Right. Right. Yeah, that would be so cool. Yeah, I remember us being, I'm sure it was a conversation maybe that we had more than once, but I remember you, me, Bonnie, who became your wife. We were in a car at night, parked. And having sort of deep, intense, angst-ridden philosophical conversation.
Yeah, those were the days, weren't they?
Right.
I mean, really, and Rich Schuldenfrei. Let's bring him in. Dr. Schuldenfrei, who spent his career at
Swarthmore, became a major philosopher at Swarthmore.
Yeah, and he used to be in on some of these conversations. And
yeah.
Boy, it was so much fun. I mean, we were very adamant about what we were trying to find out. We were, and I know a lot of people didn't understand our style of conversation because it involved a lot of yelling and jumping up and down and stuff. Remember that?
I do remember that. Well, particularly Rich, who was from New York City and had a very animated style loved debating with you. I've never been that much of a debater, but you two would lock horns and
In fact, I had a informal symposium at my house in Philadelphia in 19. Well, let's say a long time ago when I was in graduate school, on the mind-body problem. And that's really what we're still discussing here, is the mind-body problem. How does the mind, what is the physical substrate of the mind? And maybe microtubules are the answer. I don't know.
Well, I remember another one of the, you know, what people will dismissively call, what do they call them, freshman bull sessions, you know, and I remember one in your room. Where Rich was there and I was there and you were there and I don't know who else. And the thing that was being fiercely debated was one versus two. In other words, basically it was, is dualism the only thing that's possible, or can there be unity? And so we were deeply enmeshed in that kind of philosophical struggle.
Wow, we were really smart back then, weren't we? we were fantastic, shining examples of brilliant youth.
Yeah,
I can't believe it.
Well, but we were definitely wrestling with, without knowing it, we were wrestling with some pretty deep and ancient philosophical questions, psycho-philo-spiritual questions that are still with us today.
Yeah, and I think it should be an encouragement to young people. I'm assuming that young people still have these conversations. I'm hoping they do.
Yeah,
because I know they were exciting to us, and they led us in all kinds of different directions. And you know, I just to give you a simple example, I remember when I was in graduate school, I spent a whole year doing library research, trying to find if there was any drug which increased REM sleep. There is no such drug, by the way.
Wow.
But all drugs decrease REM sleep. Because, see, I think there's a very strong link between dreams, consciousness, and the kind of stuff that we're talking about now with the at the quantum level.
Okay, now that's going to be the segue into part three. We will have a future, because that was what we were going to talk about some time back, was that very topic, some of your more recent inner voyages.
In fact, that's one of the beautiful things about psychology, the study of the mind, or whatever you want to call it. You don't have to go to a university. You don't have to be enrolled in a program. You're sitting inside of your own little experimental chamber, and you can start to observe your own behavior, keeping a sleep log, keeping a dream log. You can start to investigate things on your own. Maybe if you have a friend at the same level, you can discuss them. But I would like to encourage all of your listeners to not hesitate to enter into this ongoing discussion of the mind, the brain. And in fact, I just made a note here. In 1956, when I was in the 10th grade, I wrote a paper called The Brain, the Nerve Cell, and Electricity. And that was my beginning into this world. And it's dominated my life, I must say. Even though I haven't been an academic, it has certainly dominated my thinking life. And I would encourage all of the listeners, at whatever level you're at, you know, you can start monitoring your own behavior. You can start seeing what you do, especially in the world of dreams, and how you can enter into your own subconscious. And that's the direction I'm headed in, and that's what we'll be discussing in our impromptu third part of this series.
Okay, well, that's a great wrap-up, and I just want to thank you. This has been so enlivening for me, and how wonderful to still have this strong connection over 52 years.
Yeah, I would second that, Dave. There's nobody else like you that I know, and somehow we've maintained this bond over the years, and we can still have these discussions that physically excite me. I mean, I'm ready to go right now.
Right.
I'm going to have to go out and run around the block or something.
You know? Okay.
So thanks again.
And thank you. Jerry and I hope you enjoyed this admittedly speculative conversation. Personally, the science that we're discussing is way out of my depth. However, what I am able to grasp of it does seem to open up some exciting possibilities for understanding consciousness and, as of yet, unexplained phenomena such as Jung's collective unconscious, cellular memory, psychic phenomena, and so on. If you go to the homepage at shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll find links to videos of both Dr. Hameroff and Dr. Lanza. In addition, if you Google them, you'll find lots of other fascinating links to their work. as well as on YouTube. I did send off an invitation to Dr. Hameroff, but he's not gotten back to me, other than to send an invitation to an international conference on consciousness. So that would suggest that he at least got my email. Well, after not having Jerry on the show for about 2 years, we're doing some catch-up here. And the third and possibly final installment of this particular conversation will be posted, hopefully, before long. Actually, we haven't had that conversation yet, but I think we're still planning to. So once again, we hope you will be stimulated by this one and by that coming one once it's here.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast. He's got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Let me start off by saying my heart goes out to those in Christchurch, New Zealand, who have suffered the earthquake, as well as to those in the Middle East trying to shake off authoritarian regimes. You will have received two podcasts from me this week. I hope you're not feeling oversaturated by Shrink Wrap Radio, but I wanted to insert the interview with Doug Davis about Morocco and the Middle East while it was most timely. And I also wanted to get out this second installment of my conversation with Jerry Trumbull according to the original schedule, more or less. Speaking of that conversation, I was really pleased to get enthusiastic feedback on part one of that conversation from my son Matthew, who's living in Manhattan, and his good friend Jason, both of whom posted comments on the site. It's challenging to get family and friends to listen. The old saw about a prophet in his own land, I guess. So at any rate, I'm always especially gratified when they do. If you haven't done so already, you might want to check out my latest interview at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an interview with Craig Bryan, PsyD, on preventing suicide. Dr. Bryan discusses his suicide prevention research, which has been shaped by his experience as an Air Force clinical psychologist in Iraq, working with active duty soldiers. Since 2009, rates of suicide in military populations have surpassed civilian rates. You'll need to listen to the interview or read the transcript, which is also on the site, to get the rest of this fascinating story. And speaking of transcripts, we have two new transcripts available on Shrink Wrap Radio. They are Shrink Wrap Radio number 226, Dream Sight with Jane Teresa Anderson, transcribed by Trina Fink, and number 227, Reclaiming Your Real Self with Rick Johnson, transcribed by Erica Steves. Thank you for your hard work, Trina and Erica. Once again, let me mention that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook page. Please look for it and, quotes, like it. As I've said, I'm not enough of a Facebook maven to know exactly what the value of your, quotes, liking it is, but I get all these requests from other people asking me to like this or that. So please like me. Do be sure to help evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, colleagues, fellow students, relatives, and strangers in the street. I know there's a much larger potential listenership than I've been able to get to so far. And also, don't forget to blog and Twitter about your favorite episodes. And I know that some of you have done this, and our audience has grown a bit. I think it grew in part because of my Psychology Today blog posts, which I'm way behind on. I need to get it together to come up with another blog. Another way you can support this show, of course, is by patronizing our affiliates. and enjoying the discounts they've made available to our listeners. You'll find the links to the discounts on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. Look for the links to shoebuy.com, 4inkjets.com, and angieslist.com. I've spoken about all three at some length in the past. Angie's List is strictly for those of you who live in the U.S. You know how useful and valuable the user ratings of others are on such sites as Amazon.com and Apple's App Store and other websites where users rate products. I know those always provide me with a certain amount of guidance. Well, Angie's List takes that idea and applies it to a wide variety of services offered in your area. So whether you need a dentist or a plumber or a masseuse or a contractor, you should check Angie's List for any recommendations or ratings they might have. You'll save 25% with the discount code SHRINK. Your use of these discount codes does help, but in truth, it provides Shrink Wrap Radio with only a trickle of income. That's why your donations are particularly important. A relatively small number of people are helping to support this series. For the month of January, for example, we received a total of $220 in one-time and recurring donations, for which we are very grateful, from the following very special listeners: Kim Gray, Joseph Pentany, Okofemi Akinyele, hope I got that close to that, Trevor Ehrman, Srinivasa Rao, Peter Velez, Andy Hunt, Leon Sang, Simon Huggins, Sanofsky Photography and Design, Patricia Su, Jane Chun, Alexander Rosare, Kathleen Vortman, Foxware, Mike Buchheit, I think it is. Partly it's my eyesight that's at fault here. Gary Graham, Valerie Pratt, Philip Brooks, and he's told me how to pronounce this. I've forgotten. Neam Joyce. With apologies to everybody whose name I butchered, won't you please add your name to this honor roll so that I can butcher your name too? You will feel so good exercising your generosity muscles. Just go to our homepage at shrinkwrapradio.com and click on the big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar. And thanks.
Hi, this is psychiatrist and founder of Whole Psychiatry, as well as author, Dr. Robert Hedaya, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Robert Hedaya, who will be my guest on our next episode. Well, I'd sure like to get this out before any more grass grows under my feet. Also, speaking of slippery slopes, I'm having a bit of a relapse with this throat thing and cough after I thought I was over it. Darn. So let's take a quick dip into the old email bag and be done with it. First, here's one from Marshall Lewis, who has a podcast about logotherapy and who has advertised on our top 10 widget. And he writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I hope all is well with you and yours in sunny California. Some time ago, you had asked if I would be interested in being interviewed about logotherapy." That's true. He goes on to say, "I begged off, knowing that there are others who have been involved with it for longer than I. Since then, I was interviewed once briefly about logotherapy," and then he gives me a link to that interview, and I still need to listen to it. So I plan to listen to it, and if it meets with my approval, an invitation will be forthcoming. He says, "I've also got several interviews in the can for my own podcast. These will be coming out in the coming months. As a result of all of this, I feel much more confident about being able to explain logotherapy correctly. If you've not found anyone else, and if this is a topic you still have an interest in covering, I would be happy to be interviewed or to help in any way I could. Best regards, Marshall." And Marshall, I think that logotherapy is a topic that I think would be of interest to listeners, and it's not one that we've ever covered, and I do think that you would be just fine as an exponent of it. But let me check out the link that you sent, and then I'll get in touch with you. And if I don't, feel free to contact me again. Next, we hear from Bill in Boulder, who writes, Dr. Van Nuys, I'm writing on behalf of our local Jungian Friends group, the Boulder Friends of Jung here in Boulder, Colorado. I have listened to Shrink Wrap Radio for many years and find it a fascinating and incredibly valuable resource. As co-chair of our program committee, I want to ask you if you are available for a lecture and perhaps a workshop in Boulder. As you will see from our website, we're a very active and successful Jungian organization. We've brought in many prominent therapists, analysts, and scholars from a variety of disciplines. Please know that we would be open to your thoughts on topics, but if you'll permit me, I will suggest an idea. Your years of interviews with some of the giants in the profession would be a fascinating lecture topic. Of course, as a Jungian organization, we're especially interested in all things Jung. Also, themes around depth psychology in general are of particular interest. I see from your website that you recently retired from your teaching position, and I would certainly understand it if you're not in a position to take on a speaking engagement. However, if you're interested, we would be delighted to work with you on developing a project to bring you to Boulder. I look forward to hearing from you. Warm regards. And that's from William Motes, MA, licensed professional counselor. Well, I was so excited to get this invitation. It's, you know, one of the thoughts that I've always had in the background about this podcast is that it would lead to invitations like this, opportunities to travel to other places, to give talks, and to lead workshops. And so I sent a couple of suggestions to Bill, but I think they turned out to be maybe too elementary for his group. As he pointed out, they have a nearby Jungian Training Institute, and so they get to hear lots of major figures in Jungian psychology coming through. And I'm not truly a Jungian scholar, you know. I'm an interviewer of Jungian scholars. So it may be that I don't have anything sufficiently sophisticated for that audience. So Bill and I will continue to dialogue about it a bit, but I don't know if it's going to happen or not. Some listeners communicate with me via Facebook. I'm still old school and hooked on email, but there's some evidence that the younger generation is more comfortable with Facebook and are using that instead of email. So on Facebook, I recently heard, for example, from psychotherapist Charles Allen, who responded to the first conversation that I had with Jerry Trumbull to say, I really enjoyed this. Can't wait for the next installments. Well, Charles, here you are. I hope it lived up to its promise. And subsequently, Charles posted again on Facebook. He said, just finished the Frank Ochberg interview on PTSD. That was on Wise Counsel, by the way. I think he was just wonderful to hear him discuss his background and theoretical views. One of my favorite interviews, his ideas about the treatment of PTSD were refreshing and confirming of what I believed. Well, you know, I have now done so many interviews that I didn't even recognize the name or which podcast it had been on. I'm embarrassed to say that. And so I had to kind of go searching through my archives, and I discovered, in fact, that this was an interview on Wise Counsel. And I was very excited about it at the time. It now comes back to me who Frank is. Frank Ochberg, and his very impressive background, and I'm really abashed to have forgotten all that. And as I mentioned, Charles is a therapist himself, and I suspect might be a good potential guest for one of my two podcasts. He had recommended that I interview somebody else, and I think we have that perhaps in the works, but I suspect he'd be a great interviewee as well. Also on Facebook, it was good to hear from my Irish psychoanalyst friend, who I also interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio not so long ago, Paul Omarda. I know him as Paul Moore, that I can pronounce. And he wrote, hey, David, I'm looking forward to yours and Jerry's upcoming foray into quantum mechanics and the mind. It's a topic I've recently become interested in and currently trying to get my head around. On another note, I stumbled across our podcast interview, Psychoanalysis in Ireland, used as an example on how to properly cite podcasts in the APA style manual referencing system guidelines. That's a nice piece of synchronicity, I thought. Thanks, Paul. It's always wonderful to hear from you. And I'm seeing that big things are happening on the Irish political scene right now. I wish you all well in coming through the current economic crisis there, all my friends in Ireland. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype and where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my longtime friend Jerry Trumbull for his part in today's episode. I hope you had as much fun listening as we did in creating it. I love my friend Jerry, and I hope that comes through as well. On the next episode, my guest will be, as you heard earlier, Robert Hedaya, MD, founder of an approach he calls whole psychiatry. I think it's an approach that makes a lot of sense and an episode you won't want to miss. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.